A golden dorado is a striped bass, a brown trout, a muskie, yeah. a redfish.
Yeah.
All wrapped into one fish.
Totally.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
And it's all of the most confusing parts of those fish yeah. in one fish. Welcome to the Fly Lords Podcast. My name is Joseph, and happy to be in Argentina with two people that you usually don't see because they're making all the cool stuff behind the lens. So Max, creative director, Zento, amazing photographer who pretty much 70% of what you see on Fly Lords feed these days is Zento's photos. So
your boy's busy.
Yeah, it's. I think we're going to talk about something different. Instead of bringing people on, we want to show you guys what it's like to be on these trips, talk about this amazing fish that we got to chase, our experience here at Set Fly Fishing, and just generally talk shop about this trip. We've been here. This is day 16. It's our last morning, and
that is crazy.
Yeah.
I like honestly can't believe it's been 16 days.
No,
it's been feels forever. Like it's been 2 days, and it also feels like it's been a lifetime.
I would say it feels like a year.
I mean, you came here on your birthday, and now your birthday again today.
Yeah, so
we like woke up this morning and both of us were just groaning. Like, oh, my shoulder is so shot.
So, yeah.
My
hand. Your back is hit.
Dude, I can't close my hand all the way.
I have those cuts all over my fingers from wire and 40 pound.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the backside of the pinky, dude.
Yep.
Yeah. Oh, dude. Well, that and wrangling a leader for your buddy who put their fly in a tree. I think that's where more of my cuts came from.
All right. I feel like people need to know a little bit about Dorado. Because they are an insane fish. I've fished for them 4 times now. 2 times here, and then 1 time up in Salta, and then 1 time on the lower Paraná.
Yeah.
And I feel like this place is completely different than the other fisheries that I've experienced.
Yeah. You bring that to where we have the far from home, that's the lower Paraná.
Yeah.
And I have no Dorado experience. Did you last year?
Yeah, I had experience up here.
And that was just on the upper Paraná.
Yeah, that was just here too. So it's kind of a crazy intro to it because you hear about stories from Max and other anglers from other locations where they're hunting them. And your perception of them is like they live in these small creeks and they're piled up and they'll just take a fly the second it hits the water. And then you get humbled by a place like this, but you have the opportunity of catching a fish of a lifetime, potentially a world record, with every single cast. I'll let you get into it because we're going to talk about the time it takes to potentially find a fish, whether it's 5 inches or 30 pounds.
Yeah, I mean, the upper Paraná here, what was the CFS of it? It's like
I think
30?
Well, no, they said like 10 to 15 cubic meters per second.
Right.
So
it's a gigantic river.
Yeah,
it's the biggest river I've ever seen.
That's low?
And that's low.
That equates to the low range of the river being a range of like 15 to 45,000 CFS.
Yeah,
it's like enormous. 5 to 15 cubic meters.
It feels like the lower section of Lake Champlain, which is like almost a Great Lake.
Yeah.
And it's a river. There's so much water to cover. The cool thing, though, is I feel like there's just the most prolific population of Dorado. They're constantly migrating. One thing that we learned,
compared to like other places you fish for Dorado, or just like your general observation?
Just general observations, like having fished this for X number of days, I feel like there are Dorado on every single bank.
Yeah. Like, and there could be a big one on every single bank.
Yeah, and one interesting thing that we learned from Carlos, our guide, was that it feels like when you're fishing the banks, you're casting to like woody structure, cut banks, things like that. It's like streamer fishing for brown trout.
Yeah.
But scaled up. And with brown trout and a lot of other freshwater species, when they're sitting on structure, they basically live there. Mm-hmm. Like, that's their log, that's their cut bank. They hang there for an unlimited amount of time. With these fish, they're always moving. And they'll sit on structure for like 30 seconds. Mm-hmm. They'll come up, they'll hang behind a log, they might eat something, and then they'll dive back into the channel. So you theoretically, you could float a bank over and over and over again, just back-to-back drifts, and you would be fishing to new fish every single time.
That's absurd.
It's insane. But it also is a testament to the number of fish that are in this river. Like,
totally, yeah.
There are millions and millions of dorado in the upper Paraná. And they're on this constant migration. They're not only moving mm-hmm. to eat, like they're trying to find new lies and new places that they can ambush prey, but they're just moving upstream because they have this desire to migrate, and we don't know what the science is behind that, but it's an insane fishery. It's like, it's, you can't figure it out.
Yeah, I mean,
there's no rules.
Sometimes it's even intimidating on big cold water fisheries in North America. You're like, you look at this huge river and you're like, all right, well, I'll just break it apart, like, and make it a bunch of small streams. And this river is, I don't know, 5,000 small streams across. It's huge.
Yeah.
So you can't just like pick it apart. And then not only do you have the banks, you have the rocks and all this structure in the middle of the river, like right off the main channel. That's just like, you see a rip. And you're like, all right, like, and if you get there in the morning and night, you're like, oh, like your heart starts.
That's like the scariest feeling when your guide is like, let's pull up to a rock.
Yeah.
Whoever's on the back of the boat, totally, their heart is just immediately.
Well, the coolest thing about the guides here is they have psychologically altered the way they think like a Dorado. And we've just kind of got a glimpse of it, I think. I think we've kind of gotten immersed in it being here for so long now. But the way that they switch spots, and I was actually pretty concerned about how spots get pressured, locally even, and then we learned yesterday that these fish are constantly on the move. And it's similar to the way that guides look for fish. They're always trying new places. They'll have an instinctual tick that they're like, all right, well, we got to go upstream, we got to go downstream, we got to go to this location, because these guys have years of data of how these fish move around and feed from place to place. So there's never a time where they're randomly hitting a certain spot. There's some logic behind it. And that's been really interesting, because it makes sense when you see the wetland structures that are attached to bigger systems too. It's insane that a fish decided to just go that far for what? They have tons of food in their backyard.
Yeah.
Why go on this exploration for 900 miles, you know? And it's absolutely mind-blowing. Like when we were in the Ibirá wetlands, we learned how far the Corrientes River is and that the fish can't really spawn in the wetlands. So they are migrating from the Corrientes River into like that. Why?
Well, we still have to figure out if that's true.
Well, yeah, that too.
Like, because like Andy was saying, the Andy, Argentina Andy, so we have, there's gonna be two different Andys. The
Andy from Babylon.
Andy from AKA Babylon.
Argentina Andy.
Yeah, been guiding for 2,000 years.
Yeah, he's been guiding for 2,000 years. He actually formed the wetlands.
Yeah.
And then there's Andy Danielchuk, who is from America, UMass Amherst. But Andy from Babylon, he was saying that all the fish that, like, he has a friend that is a guide in the, like, upper part of the Corrientes River, and they don't catch fish that are the same size that they do, or they did, in the Ibirá Marsh. Like, and the whole thing with the marsh is it might have become disconnected because there was a huge drought, and, like, we saw the effects of that, and, like, you see it on the guides, and they're like, they don't take clients there right now because they want people to have the best experience. But it's just like, we were part of the scouting mission.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. We were the probe, and the El Nino usually brings a lot of water, and it's brought drought. this time around. The par not, Carlos was saying yesterday, like, this is the lowest he's seen it in a really long time during this time of year.
Two years ago in November, when we were here, there were rocks that were 5 feet under the surface, and now they're 5 feet out of the water.
Right, exactly.
Insane. What?
Yeah. Those rocks above the island that are sticking out, those were deep.
Yeah, those those were some of those crazy hydraulic turbulent rips that we're fishing elsewhere. So you wouldn't even fish a lot of the rocks that we're fishing right now, because
there's just
the flow will just blow over. Yeah, it wouldn't even hold there.
That's insane.
Yeah.
And the water clarity was super different.
The water clarity was unbelievable.
Yeah.
It's like this deep aquamarine blue, like beautiful clear water. You can see these gold flashes when you get a refusal. Yeah. It's so cool. And it's so unlike a lot of the other Argentina Dorado fishing, where it's like the brown water.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Blind hunting.
Yeah. And you're still blind hunting.
Well, yeah, big time.
Sometimes.
Well, we did get to do the flats, which is, it's funny because you're out in a river, and you're out walking these sand flats, and you're thinking like, I wonder how these fish are gonna flow in on this tide, but you're in a river and there's no tide.
Yeah, it legit feels like you're in the salt.
Yeah,
like it feels so like wading a northeast flat for stripers.
Yeah, exactly.
And you're walking the flat, and you're like, I'm gonna have to clean all my stuff off with fresh water after I get back. And I mean, Max and I were walking this flat, and I'm like thinking that in my head. And I think you had the same thought at the same time. I'm like, I feel like I should clean my gear when we get back. And it's like, no,
we're in fresh water.
Fresh water.
You're chilling, man.
All right, I feel like we should talk about the flats, because that was an insane experience in this crystal clear water.
Yeah. And hearing about the experience from last year, Rachel's fish, all that stuff, like you see the video and it's chocolate milk. And we get here before we got here, when we were meeting with Andy and Gustavo and the set team, they're like, yeah, you can wade these sand flats in sight fish, like for Dorado. And we're like, okay. What does that mean? And the first day, first morning, we like bomb it up river. We were together, Max and I, and we pull up to this like sandbank, and you see the sabalo everywhere.
Which sabalo are the bait fish for Dorado, and they're these. It's like a carp. It's like a carp mixed with a chub or a shad or something.
And a mullet.
They're like 5-pound fish.
They could be like 20 pounds though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're
huge. Big.
Yeah, like the average ones that we've been seeing around 20 inches.
Yeah. That's the primary forage for these Dorado that we're throwing tiny little flies at.
Everything in the
like this is micro compared to
the sabalo.
Compared to it.
Yeah. The bait fish.
I mean, everything in this river runs on sabalo. It's the they make the world
fish.
They make the world go around. Yeah. If you get reincarnated as a sabalo, you did something really wrong. So it's similar to a menhaden in the bass fishery. It's similar to a mullet and some other fisheries where everything predatory relies on this one fish. Yeah. So these guys care as much about the sabalo as they do the Dorado.
Yeah. So we pull up to the flat, and you see sabalo like popping everywhere, kind of like they just scare themselves sometimes too.
Yeah, it's
too.
Just like little tail
because everything's
like a bunker.
Yeah, everything's trying to kill it, so it's even scared of other sabalo. But we pull up to the tip of this sandbar, and you just see like Max was making the noise with his foot in the water. It was hilarious, but you just. Like you just, and it's
blitzes.
It's blitzes and it's loud, and you could be 500 yards from it and it's unmistakable.
Yeah. It sounds like a full on washing machine.
Yeah. So we're seeing this happen downstream from where we are.
Yeah.
And Andy's like, they're hunting. And we're like, oh, okay.
That's always such a good sign when you hear your guide go, look, the Dorados, they're hunting.
They're hunting. Yeah. Especially in Carlos's voice.
It's somehow frantic and not frantic all at the same time.
It's just intense. It's like this sinking feeling. You're like, oh,
It's like yeah,
it's gonna go down.
Yeah, this can go down. So we start making our way, and you have to like quickly but gently make your way down the sandbank because the fish spook, like, they're this, like, they just want to, they're seeing red in that moment, and they're like, but the sabalo are really tight to the bank, like in water that's probably,
it's less than a foot deep.
Less than a foot deep. And so you're like kind of going around, trying to stay as far from the water as you can, while also keeping eyesight on where the fish might be. And usually you don't get it like that, where you just pull up to the sandbank and the dorados are already hunting. You just stand there with your line out, the fly in your hand, and your rod, and you just wait.
Well, yeah, the goal is, if you don't want to push the sabalo off the bank, they're coming up into shallow water because everything at the bottom of the river is terrifying.
Yeah.
So they're like, the skinnier that I go, the further I am away from the mouth of a dorado.
Yeah, because the dorado will hang. Andy and Lucas, like all the guides tell you that those dorados hang on that drop off. And when you see those sabalo push up into the shallow water, it means that there has to be a fish like somewhere along that drop off that they don't want to hang out with. So the first group of feeding we see kind of finish. We wade down as we're working our way down, like almost like red fishing, like you see this big push. Or any flats fishing, like, and
yeah,
the push
that
is
slow bow wave.
Yeah, that push is very different than a bait fish wave. And make a few casts at some pushes, nothing. And then all of a sudden, just the bank erupts.
Yeah, it was mayhem, like full 360.
Yeah.
They were like 10-second long foamers.
Yeah. So Andy and I are like sprinting down this sandbank, like the fly line's out. Your fly's out, you're like trying to be semi like stealthy as you're doing it and just sprinting down the bank. We get to where they were like blitzing, and you see the sabalo start getting nervous, and then it happens, like, but in two different spots. So Andy runs to the right and he's like casting at blitzing fish, and like the camera footage is chaotic. Like, Max is focused on Andy. Another group starts blitzing to the left of us, and I start running to that, and I like start casting. You see the camera like quick pan over, and Max start like walking towards me. I completely duff my first cast. Like, first cast of the trip.
Yeah, basically. Yeah.
Pretty much.
How can you not?
You're so nervous and in that moment.
You see, like, in this blitz, these dorado, their backs are out of the water because they're so shallow, and they're just, like, pissed, and they want to kill these sabalo. And by some means found some peace in my head, and just, like, there was a fish coming back around and let it, like, 3 feet past, three
like
feet long.
I, like, watched you have, like, a moment of zen. You were, like...
Yeah.
And then you like perfectly led this fish 3 feet past it, 3 feet in front of it, dragged the fly across its nose.
Yeah, dragged the fly across its nose, and that fish was so pissed off and angry and wanted to kill so bad that he just went, crushed that thing. And I was like, oh my God. This is like, I was like, all right, what do I do now? Like, do I put it, like, I haven't caught one of these. Do I put it on the reel? Do I try to like strip it? But I was just like, in that moment too, you're like, don't trout set.
You don't want to be that guy.
Want to like absolutely lay into that fish, and it stuck. I mean, also that fish did everything in its power to put the hook in the right place.
It was a perfect corner shot.
Yeah, it was a perfect corner shot. The fish coming across, laid in front, it turned to eat it, and you set it, so like when you set it, it's pretty much already in the corner of its mouth, and it just jam, good penetration, fish stuck, got to interact with it. And
that was the craziest first dorado experience anyone has ever had.
Hands down, dude. Feet in the sand, sight fish to dorado, come on, dude.
But it's not always like that.
No,
these fish are humbling.
Oh, absolutely.
Incredibly.
They will take everything you think you know and crush it.
Oh, yeah.
You're nothing.
Yeah, I've had quite the journey.
Yeah, your journey.
Well, I mean,
insane.
You too. You know, it's funny. We came 2 years ago and Rachel bangs one out real quick. Awesome fish. Max, maybe an hour or so later, got another mega. And at that point, my perception of this fishing is like, well, if it's cloudy, then it's just on and everybody can catch a big fish. And I don't think I'm that great of an angler, but I've done some things in fishing that I thought maybe I'm prepared for something like this, you know, and the river knew and it didn't want to cut me a break. It's not easy. It doesn't come like that. And
well, I also think this river specifically, it plays a different game, and it's the kind of river where it like tries to play psychologically with you.
Absolutely, yeah.
It digs into your brain, yeah. And it makes you question everything.
Yeah, and exactly. The guides will tell you that you can't, like, there's no math that figures this river out. It's not like this tide, this wind, this moon, this bank, big fish.
Right.
Because
they're always moving.
They're always moving, and like, I don't know, I felt like yesterday we were trying to do some math in the past 2 days. We were like, all right, well, the guides generally like cloudy, rainy, pressure drop, river coming up, the fishing gets really good.
Yeah.
And like, we're like looking at my Garmin watch every 5 minutes to like see what the pressure's doing. And I think we were trying to do math and the river was like, hey,
yeah,
assholes.
I mean, last time that we were here, pretty much every time we went to the rocks, we would throw on a sinking line and a big fly, and we would at least move a fish. Mm-hmm. And so we thought we had it all mapped out. I tied these hybrid changers. We made a big old Buford beast who's seen better days.
Yeah, it was a bit puffier than that.
I caught
it
a fish
was a
on
lot
one
puffier
of those.
Than that. Yeah.
On rocks?
No, I'm not saying they didn't work. I'm just saying we walked into this fishery with that Western confidence of like, oh, I know what to do. I can make this happen. We're going to pull 30, 40 pounders off the rocks every single time. No issue. Like, we got the flies. Oh, totally. We've got the setups.
Well,
we know how to fish them. And then you get there and nothing happens.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think it's funny. I mean, even, I guess, game species in the U.S. that will help relate to people is like a striped bass or, you know, a steelhead. I'll take those two. But it was funny when Carlos, he started to tell us like old stories about like his fish bum days. And Marcelo, his mentor, who will guide here every now and then as well, he was telling us one season they went 28 for 30 on big fish, like fish over like 20, 25 pounds. And then the next season they went one for like 28, I think.
Yeah. It was like the straight reverse.
And it's just I think people who steelhead really hard and or surf cast or look for specifically big bass know that feeling of what am I doing wrong? Because sometimes everything goes right. You bang out fish after fish after fish landed, and you get really confident, and then you get humbled by the next season or maybe the next tide cycle or week where you're dropping every fish and you just can't get one to stick and you're not doing...
Or you can't even find them.
Yeah, or you can't find them, but you're not doing anything wrong or different. And I think it's like that, but on a whole new level on this river. And that aspect of fishing keeps anglers hungry and around fisheries because it's an enigma you're never going to figure out. You will never master it. You'll never be Pokemon master of fish. And this is the ultimate that we've seen where it embodies every game species that we've ever tried to fish for in one and then adds a ton more variables that just are impossible to turn in constants.
Yeah, a striped bass or a golden dorado is a striped bass, a brown trout, a muskie, yeah. A redfish.
Yeah.
All wrapped into one fish.
Totally.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
And it's all of the most confusing parts of those fish in one fish.
Things that you could turn into constants with other fish, these don't do that. So it's the ultimate. I mean, I was telling Max on the boat, I was like, man, I'm glad we don't have Dorado at home because I think we would be ultimately ruined.
Oh, it would destroy us.
Yeah, I don't think we would have jobs, companionship, et cetera.
Yeah. Our girlfriends would not be around.
I can't believe that the guides' girlfriends and wives stay around. They just like do this for 90 days straight and like maybe go home like once every 3 weeks for like a day.
Yeah.
Like, that's crazy. But they're that crazy about these fish.
Well, they love these fish. I mean, they got Dorado tats. They're like so addicted to these fish, and they get as excited as we do every time that we pull up to a new spot. They're like, come on, Dorado.
or just as frustrated or disappointed.
Yeah,
you
make this perfect shot, and they're like, oh, why? Yeah. Why no, Dorado?
Yeah. Or just a ton of profanity that I wish I learned a little bit better.
But as far, like, stepping back a little bit, as far as, like, us being here and what our trip looked like. So we started here, we ended here in Itati.
Yeah.
Starting in the sandbanks. And just, like, how things have changed through the trip weather-wise is crazy.
Oh, yeah. It was 100 degrees and sunny when we got here. And I died.
Yeah. Casually died.
Yeah, you casually died.
Yeah. Drink water.
And eat.
Because you need salt. I went to the hospital 2 times on this trip in 2 different cities.
Yes.
I think we need to make it well known that that wasn't any fault of the lodge or our host.
It was not the lodge. No.
The lodge actually was incredible. Max likes to not eat sometimes.
Yeah. If all we're serving is eggs.
Well, yeah, the Argentines love their eggs. There might be a surplus of eggs where we have a shortage in the U.S., although that might be fake. Max doesn't like to eat the eggs, so there's been meals where they're just so egg-ridden, he's probably better off not eating them.
And that was lunch on the first day.
Yeah, it resulted in an electrolyte water deficiency or imbalance and ended up being... We classified it as a heat stroke, right?
Yeah,
the fever was high enough that I think it bridged into heat stroke. There was no organ failure, though.
So yes. I think you were on that line of we got you to the hospital and we got you cooled down. And I think, like, if we had waited another hour, you probably would have gone into heat stroke.
It would have been bad.
And it would have been it would have been the difference between like the Itati hospital and like
going to Buenos Aires.
Flying you to Buenos Aires on like a charter flight. So,
yeah.
I mean, that was like.
I was out for 7 days.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is crazy. We lost our big fish machine for 7 days.
The creator of all things pretty. So.
Then you guys got all my flies eaten.
Yeah, the piranhas, man. We'll finish your death story, and then we'll get into the piranhas, because I have a newfound hate for piranhas, because they're massive here for some god-awful reason.
And their gill plate looks like a Dorado.
Yeah, which they look cool. I'll get to the one joke, but yeah, Max ended up living in the most beautiful La Alondra Lodge. He's still dying, but... in a really beautiful place. So we knew our sweet boy was at home and being well taken care of, and we got updates on him through the Garmin InReach. But the three of us had to go into the Abira Marsh without our fearless leader and pick things up. We were touched on it briefly, where that was where they experienced some drought and disruption in fish migration. And it was a bit of a recon mission. We were looking for
that and like
fish.
Omar, who is this gaucho that grew up in that marsh, was born in a house that you could see from one of our camps, was like, yeah, the caiman don't know there's a drought. They're just gonna munch on Dorado. So that place is insane.
Oh, incredible.
The capybaras, the marsh deer, all the birds, the aquatic life seems there.
Totally. Yeah, the native. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, but you have these fish that, like, they're more, I think they're more fragile than people might think, the Dorado. Like, you hear from, y'all have heard it from Carlos, like, the fishery's doing better than it probably was when he was a kid because you're no longer allowed to kill them in this province. So, but the other predatory species in the marsh environment don't have to follow those regulations. So who knows what happened? Like, there's all these theories. Like, did the fish get disconnected from the Corrientes River where they were going to spawn? Did the drought dry up so much stuff and concentrate the fish to other locations that, like, you might not be able to get to, because the islands literally move. Mm-hmm. Like, the ground in the marsh, like, they've cut channels to get you to and from camp, and you get to this channel, and you get to a point in the channel where the channel just ends, and Andy and Lucas were like,
yeah, it was here.
It was here. It's not.
Yeah, this is a mirage. Well, it's something out of like a Miyazaki movie. They're literally floating islands.
Yeah.
And you see current coming underneath an island, and there should be a break off of the tip of the island, but there isn't. And it's just going straight underneath as if the cut bank is 30 feet deep under. And it makes sense that things are shifting around constantly. And yeah, we had a really good time getting through, creating somewhat new channels to get to our camps. And yeah, I mean, the points that you made about, you know, other native species not having to really follow the rules makes a ton of sense with what we were seeing.
Less water means the prey items are way more available and concentrated. And
absolutely.
Easy to pick off by the predators.
Dorado is probably up there as far as like apex predator in a river, like under the water.
Mm-hmm. Dorado and beaten the caiman.
Those caiman are wild.
Oh yeah.
I mean, they're not like you'd see American alligators and things like that, but I mean, you go buy one and it opens its mouth and you're reminded, like, I'm not as big as I thought I was.
Yeah, 5 foot caiman.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a, well, it's funny. There's, so Omar has done a lot of tourism there. And I was, it's so wild, yet some of the older caiman, it almost looked like they've seen humans before. And there's some that just didn't spook and just stared at us. Mm-hmm. And that was terrifying, but also comforting at the same time. Like, maybe he wouldn't lunge at me. But yeah, that dude, that was cool. And the piranha thing, I'll get to real quick. So Max is down. He tied a ton of flies. I didn't have a ton of time to tie flies before this. I tied as much as I could while he's in the hospital right before we left, and I tossed one mouse just to see how it swam and got it back, and the tail was gone and a whole chunk of deer hair was gone off the back of it. And I was like, are you serious? What is this? And they were like, ah, piranha.
Palometta.
And I was like, huh. And then they kept calling them, well, I didn't realize they were calling them palomettas, and I made a joke about freshwater permit being in this marsh and we're looking for it because it's elusive. And then they catch this piranha and they call it a palometta. And I'm like, oh, what? Now everybody's in on my joke. But it's funny because they get huge. And I was calling them DPP, dinner plate piranha, because they get to the size of a dinner plate. And they're huge. And
do you have a fly that's been piranha?
Oh, yeah. Here you go. So oh, that was...
That is what piranhas will do.
That was longer than this.
Yep.
And it just, so you get a little tap and you get it real excited.
It's also like perfect little apple bite out of the deer hair.
Yeah. You think like
that is insane.
You think a Dorado's on it. You're really excited. Something's tapping it. And then you see the little swirl and you're just like, ugh. And you feel your fly half the amount of weight on it. And you're like,
yeah,
I just got wrecked.
It's like the tiniest little touch.
For sure.
I caught a few of them.
You did. Yeah. You were
and
good
I was
at doing
like,
that.
Over the side of the boat, like pliers way back. Like you're looking at their teeth and they're all perfectly triangle sharp.
Horrifying.
And their teeth match up perfectly. Like
It's just with razor each other. Blades,
it's just razor blades.
And well, like not in there, but in other locations with piranhas, you'll catch a Dorado and like you're like, where's their tail? Where'd it go? And, yeah, they think that, I mean, it's competition with other Dorado, but definitely piranha influenced.
Yeah.
They gang up on fish.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that Dorado tail looks just like a red and yellow fly.
Yeah, but, yeah, and it looks appetizing if I was a piranha.
I'll take a bite of that.
Oh, yeah. They're doing their own fin clips.
All right. Should we talk about the nursery?
The nursery.
Oh, yeah.
That we think is a nursery. See, like...
Well, that's the thing.
It's the thing. Theorize, you hear from the guides and all the people here that, like, they have their theories of what's going on in this river system, but it's not backed up by science because no science has ever been done on Dorado.
Which is insane. Like, it's such a... important game fish, and there's so much tourism around these fish.
Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely.
From Bolivia down to here.
Well, so there
and
is.
We don't know anything about them.
There is a like very small amount. There's only been two studies on Dorado been done. One of them was by Andy Danielchuk, but it's a genetic study that has been done in Salta and in all over like. More north of here, and then they have like a few fin clips from the upper Paraná, but the Ibra Marsh and the Asora Marsh, there's nothing. So there's this, and Andy, please forgive me if I speak incorrectly, and everyone in the science community, but I'm gonna try to repeat what he's been saying is, basically, you can use the fin clips from all these different places to get the DNA and map this species genetically to figure out, all right, is it the same species of fish in the Ibra Marsh that's in the upper Paraná, that's in the Asora Marsh, or are they
the
different?
The same genetics.
Yeah, the same genetics. Species. Well, Andy was saying there's different subspecies right. within. But yeah, are
like
they
the
same?
Bolivian fish are... completely different.
Could be, yeah, yeah. So, yeah, are the genetics the same or are they different and are they mixing in certain places? Or so we needed 15 fin clips from Isoro. We needed 15 from Ibera. We did not get 15 from the Ibera wetlands. But Lucas, the guide, and he's going to teach all the other guides from what Andy showed him and left him a fin clip kit. And when they go back and continue their scouting missions, every fish they catch, they're going to take a fin clip, send it back to UMass, and hopefully we'll have some data here in the next however long.
Yeah, it's kind of cool that we're like part of the scientific future of Dorado. Like we get to witness the beginning of this research.
It was cool to take.
Which is so wild.
Yeah.
I was pumped when Andy showed me how to do it. Like,
yeah. Oh,
I mean, it's incredible. I mean, just to be fishing for them is one thing, but to be caring about them and helping these guys figure them out and protect them better and do everything that we can to understand how to protect them even, you know? It's
right, that's the thing.
We need that data to protect them. And Argentina's done a great job with their conservation efforts, but we need to go the extra mile.
Well, Corrientes province, yeah. Specifically.
Yes, right.
You can kill them down south.
Right. Well, you can kill them not far from here. Like you can be.
You can kill them.
You can kill them across the river in Paraguay.
Yeah.
You go farther south where the river goes through Corrientes and Resistencia, and on one bank you can kill a Dorado, and on the other bank you can't. It's really interesting. Like,
I feel like it's what's really cool about it is so many of our fisheries in the United States are in trouble. Like our favorite fisheries, striped bass, your steelhead fishery, like they're in a bad spot right now. And we're doing all this reactive conservation work. We're trying to like fix the mess that we've created as an angling community, and largely due to our inability to work together and find common ground. But yeah, a lot of our fisheries are in trouble and we're just like, okay, how do we bring it back? How do we fix it? And this fishery, they've been doing work for a long time to try to protect these fish. And Andy, in his lifetime of fishing for Dorado here, has seen the population grow. He's like, it's better than it's ever been. And it just keeps getting better. And there's more and more fish. And we're at a point with this fishery where we have an opportunity to do proactive conservation work instead of reactive conservation work, which is incredible. I wish we had that in the United States.
I feel like all of our films that have a conservation aspect to it, it's like, this fish is screwed, like, unless we do something right now.
Yeah.
Whereas this set was like, we love this fish. We see these pristine environments, similar to like what Andy Danielchuk's doing in the Seychelles. It's like, how can you make sure these incredible fisheries stay incredible fisheries?
Yeah.
And we're not like worried about a moratorium or this fish just going extinct.
And pure genetics too. It's still pure here. It hasn't been meddled with, which is also a rarity globally these days with all fish, especially glamour species, you know, because people have tried to meddle and make more or bring them back somehow. So like you were saying, we have an incredible opportunity to preserve here.
I think we should talk about what fishing on the rocks is like.
Oh.
When you, so the rocks are like rock pile reef type structures in the middle of the river, and you're backing down on this, essentially swinging flies and dredging into the structure and then stripping them out of it. And when your guide is like, all right, it's time to go try a rock. One thing that everybody knows about the rocks is they hold big fish.
And you see it too. Like the conditions are right, you see
early
them.
Early in the morning, these fish, you can see 30, 40 pound fish rolling.
Yeah.
It's like tarpon. They're just porpoising. Yeah. You see the head, the dorsal, and the tail.
They're looking at you.
Come out of the water. Yeah, they like eye you. They're like, I'm not going to fall for that.
For sure.
But you, so that you pull up, you swing the boat around, trolling motor on spot lock, and angler on the stern. We mix it up between full intermediate lines and multi-density sinking lines with medium and large flies. Like, not the biggest flies, but stuff like this size. You know, 9-10 inches. Mm-hmm. And you back down onto these rocks very slowly, and you keep making casts. So you cast across stream, and you mend your line, get your fly down.
Stack mending.
Yep, just stack mending line, and get a straight line so you're swinging right in front of the rock, and then you pull it out of the structure, and it's like this slow, smooth strip trying
There's
to
so much tension on the line.
Oh yeah, you can, the river is just raging.
It's the tightest line grab you could do.
Yeah.
And the guide, when you get to those rocks, the guide is like, there's a different tone on the boat.
Yeah.
You're on the banks and you're like casting and everybody's goofing around and laughing and you get to the rocks and you're just like,
it's silence.
All right, it's go time.
Yeah.
And everybody on the boat is just hyper-focused, watching the line, waiting for something to boil or jump. And when...
Well, the most intense moment is, I think, you've let your cast out, you've stack mended, the line's swinging, you see that tension, you see it straight, you know where the line is, and you're sitting there.
And you're waiting and for you're your waiting. Guide to say, okay, now strip.
Yes, that. When you're just like sitting there and you're holding the line and you're like just thinking, when is he going to say it? When he's going to say it? When is he going to say it? Yes, now strip. And you just go, that's like.
Oh, it's so intense.
Yeah.
And then you start stripping and you're bringing this fly right through the structure. And you these guys are so dialed.
Yeah.
They know to the inch where your fly is sitting.
Yeah.
They're like, wait, wait, wait.
Yeah.
Now. And You hit that moment and you're bringing it in and you're bringing it in, and then all of a sudden you just hit an absolute wall. It feels like
you snagged for sure.
Yeah, it feels like you snagged a rock.
Oh yeah.
It's like a freight train. Well, it feels like a boulder was tumbling down river and grabbed your line.
And then your line just goes full piano wire. And then you gotta hang on for it for dear life, not burn your hands and dry line or whatever. And then hopefully it erupts and doesn't come off.
Yeah. And we got real humbled by the rocks.
Yeah.
Last year, I got a really nice fish off the rocks.
Oh, yeah.
And it felt like it was a repeatable process.
Oh, yeah.
This
yeah.
year,
Zento
last
and I,
night.
Zento and I have now come full connection over getting screwed by fish on the rocks.
Absolutely wrecked by these fish.
I might have a little bit more, but
you have a little bit more.
Last night we had a fish come up, and they'll do this thing where they don't fully commit to eating the fly. They'll just like swat at it.
Yeah.
And so you feel this little pluck.
Yeah.
And last night we had a fish that came up 30 feet beyond the boat, and the boil that this fish made was like a whale kicked its tail.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. It was enormous.
Yeah.
It was, and everybody's heart is just like pounding, and you're just like, why?
Yeah.
Why didn't that fish stick?
Dude, like that on top of all the other heartbreakers was just the cherry on top, knowing that you only have half an hour left to make it happen. yeah, that one was the same size as the one that I had bite 10 inches of wire.
Fully inhaled your fly along with 10 inches of wire and bit through 40-pound fluoro like it was butter.
Well, had two sets of rocks. I've yet to convert a fish over 20 or even over 15. Cast, swing, the whole thing is perfect. I told Jackson, I was like, I'm sorry, dude, but I got to do this. Everything is right. I have a tingle in every part of my body. My fish senses are tingling, and I don't know. You spend enough time doing this stuff, you can smell it, you can feel it. You wake up, you know something. You need to at least try. I got up on there, and we set up on these rocks that were new to me, because of these flows. You know, didn't get to fishies last year, and knew exactly where that fish is going to be holding. Lucas and I were on the same page, in sync, and fish came tight. It's around a 25-pound fish, full piano wire, just reefing on it. About to go back to the rod after I felt the hook cinch in, and jumps, lands in the water, comes off, get the fly back. I'm like, please tell me what I did wrong. I need to know what I could have done wrong. I did something wrong. Please tell me I did something wrong. And it's like, no, man, that's just fishing. And it's like... God, that's like, it's hard to hear that because it's like, how do I fix that? How do I not have that happen again and not be at the mercy of the Dorado gods? But I guess that's what's so great about it.
Yeah.
And then three casts after on the next set of rocks, just stripping to the boat and be making jokes about musky figure eighting of how many interactions we get at the boat. I had maybe a foot of fly line left, and I just see the biggest body that I've ever seen in this river. It was a literal wall of gold, and we have it on camera. The amount of water it moved, it shook the boat with a wake, and I watched it inhale the fly, and I strip set on it like that, and it just, like butter, came clean back at me.
Like barely, you had no tension on the strip
barely
set.
A jolt in my hand or the rod, and I just get the leader. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. I get the fly back. There is no fly. It's just a clean cut leader. I was like, I was ready to blame my knot. I was ready to come down on myself for something. And Lucas is like, yeah, you know, it's a rarity where I tell somebody to tie on 2 feet of wire before we hit a spot. You know,
fish's head was probably this big.
It's ridiculous. Yeah, they don't even get that long. They just get tall and wide. And we see how much water they move. It is insane. It's like, it's like a boulder flew up from the bottom of the river and shook everything.
That constant evidence of a potential 40-pound fish keeps you going.
Yeah, it keeps you high. And it, you know, I almost think it's a funnier. Lucas. There's Lucas over there. I think it's funnier that way. And I think that's what makes this place the ultimate.
Well, no, I was just gonna say, I think we should talk about what happened last year and what your reaction was to it and how you came into it.
My maturing.
Yeah. You did though, you grew up.
My becoming of a man. yeah, totally, yeah. So, I mean, everybody kicked it off like it was so easy. And
Rachel got a 30-pound fish. I got a 25-pound fish. I got like a 30 to 35-pound fish.
25 after, like right after. Yeah, you know, and felt like I was competent of an angler. You know, I live, breathe, die fishing, especially for predatory fish like this. You know, and I was in a bad way. That's what I call it. I was in a bad way, you know.
You were just watching everybody around you have the most incredible fishing experience and you weren't getting interactions.
And I had this like immature reaction to it by thinking that I was entitled to that experience too. Why can't I have that too? And I was in this weird funk where it was hard to get out of that, you know? It's like,
and with that you were like, you were hitting the bank with your cast.
For sure.
And like blowing up drifts because you just couldn't like focus. You were like trying too hard.
Exactly, yeah. And that's where there's good being in a good way and a bad way. And there's certain fish that react to that. You know, you could go to catch a bunch of bluegills in a bad way. It would probably be all right. But when it comes to these types of fish where the stars need to align and to do it consistently, you need to be in a good way. And the best way I can describe being in a good way is to have a level head, being completely humble, not worrying about what's gonna happen, what might not happen. It doesn't matter. It's just fishing.
Just focus on the cast that you're making and then focus again on the next cast.
If your brain can go white noise, good on you. You're probably gonna be an amazing Dorado fisherman. but if your brain is racked with worries and all these different things and blaming yourself and coming down on yourself for little things that you could have done better, and you know, that's where I think the fish can almost sense it. It's like a horse sensing fear or pit bull, you know, sensing your fear of them or anger. And you know, these are fish that I'm talking about with a brain smaller than a walnut, and I'm giving them a lot of credit here, but I think that they genuinely can do that. And I've, since having that experience and knowing where I was and growing up and trying to apply that to other fisheries, I've had a lot more success. I probably had the best year of fishing of my life last year applying all of that.
After getting destroyed
yes,
by this.
Yes, like immediately after I went home and I was like, I gotta work on myself, you know? I need to become, not just a better angler, but I think it'll help me become a better person. And it was an amazing life lesson, you know? It helped me grow up.
It's crazy that a fish can do that to you.
It's one of the most incredible things, you know? There's life lessons that like you can apply to every problem that you have that I've learned through fishing.
Well, I think that's just something cool about fishing in general, is it like forces you to be introspective and open up about yourself emotionally and
absolutely,
like try to work through your own
Yes.
Like we've, on these boat rides to and from spots and to and from the lodge, we've been having the deepest conversations about life and success and what it needs to happen to move forward and have the best quality of life. And
things get said on a skiff that won't get said in a therapist's office.
No, but for real.
because
you're so humbled.
I have a shout out flip.
Because you're so humbled in this situation, and everybody on that boat is so bonded together. You're like on this quest to do this impossible task.
That like energy that was on the boat 2 days ago was unreal.
Yeah.
Like that like bond,
it was electric.
It's like you just feel that something big's gonna happen just because like everyone's in a good way, is excited, wants to rotate, wants like you want like someone else on the boat
team fish
to get the fish more than you want the fish.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you're just
whoever
like,
whoever gets it, it doesn't matter. It's just about that boat catching a fish.
Yeah. Yeah. And like Carlos was a part of that. And like, it was just amazing. And other things happened that day that kind of put me in a bad way for a little bit. But
like missing a giant fish.
Yeah. Two.
Yeah. But yeah, it's just like, and then you end up, that leads into having incredible conversations that aren't about Dorado. It just teaches you about who you are as a person and teaches you a lot of life lessons.
Oh, absolutely.
I feel like it's one of the best ways to start growing up.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And
if you have the kind of brain where you can
self-reflect and
reflect and take away from it and be critical.
Yeah, think critically. Yeah. And one of the funniest ones was Lucas is, I think, quadruple lingual. I don't know. Speaks a million languages, but the dude has the funniest, driest humor.
Oh, yeah.
And we also have that, and we share that. So no matter how much he dislikes me for other reasons that I'm not too sure of, at least we can bond with our styles of humor. And Max, Lucas, and I had such a good thing going. It's bright sun. We're not too hopeful, but we're trying, you know? And they're like, you're up, Zento, because you need your fish. And they had me fishing for like 6 hours, I think. I was just dead.
Oh, and yeah. No, I refused to get on the back of the
boat. He refused to fish. They just watched me, and we just made jokes for 6 hours straight. And I was like, I'm dying, man. I got to sit down for a bit. And you're like, I'll take a couple of casts. I think five casts in is just, yup. And Max is stomping on the bow, on the stern of the boat, like it's trying to scare it like it's a tarpon.
Oh, get I forgot
out
about
from
that.
Underneath the
fish. Yeah, jumps and then yeah, comes
races.
Right under the boat.
Yeah, sounds. Races right under the boat, and Max is stomping. And like, I'm so stoked, but I'm also like, are you kidding me? And it was funny because Max is like, we need one shot, and it's a giant Dorado jumping. So here's the camera, pre-record, just press the button. And I'm like, cool. And then so he hooks the fish, I'm like, press the button. But yeah, that's like when I was in a bad way, you know, and I think that's a direct contrast to like what we were doing, you know.
Yeah.
Obviously, I was still really stoked. Like, just to see a creature like that in person is insane. But yeah, you know, it's funny. It teaches you all these lessons, and this is a great fish to try it out on.
Yeah. And it can happen to anyone. Like, there's a kid here at the lodge with us who has never fly fished before. Yeah. And he caught
a big fish.
Really nice fish, like 15-pound fish.
Yeah.
That's never fly fished before.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And we're working our asses off trying to, like, find a big fish.
For sure.
And we can't connect with anything over 10 pounds on this trip.
Yeah.
The fish doesn't care.
They're there. They don't care who's on the other end of the line.
Yeah.
Yeah, Lucas was saying, like, fish doesn't care if you're throwing a $1,200 rod with an able reel, custom able reel, and have, like, the nicest car at home, or if you got to the river in a canoe and are, like, throwing, like, hand-me-down gear. Like, the fish don't care.
Yeah.
Like, it
doesn't matter who you are.
Yeah. Well, the deepest part of what Lucas said about that one was they don't care if you're a janitor or a surgeon.
Yeah.
You could be at any class level in our society, and they don't give a shit about who you are, your accomplishments are. So he sees more guys that are surgeons in high level positions getting angry on the boat than anybody else because they feel like they worked to get there somehow, but the fish doesn't care.
No.
Well, yeah. And I feel like it's also about, like, right place, right time, right energy.
Yeah, right.
I feel like it really comes down to that. Like, the fact
that
somebody who's never fly fished before can catch a really big fish here.
Yeah.
Just goes to show that so much of this fishery is right place, right time, good luck.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Absolutely. And these fishers have crazy hydraulic push. Like, a lot of the barbless flies that end up in a fish's mouth, while it's in the net, they'll just suck it back through their gill plate, and the fly's hanging out. And I was telling Joseph, like, a trout, man, like, they can come up, like, trout, like, grabbing sticks and touching them with their mouths. They're curious. Yeah. And, like, a drug probably could have just, I mean, that fly is, like, this big. They're used to eating things this big. It's a snack. And he comes up, sips it, I like that, and then spits it out, you know? And
well, I was thinking after that second fish, I was like, well, maybe just because of the current and everything, like, I couldn't strip fast enough to get it in its mouth. Like, I'm just gonna two-hand strip the rest of the trip. But you guys have been a bit
of a theory about the two hand strip.
Well, so Dad yesterday on the boat.
Dad's Carlos.
Yes. I missed the really big fish, and it was just a pluck, and I'm steady two-hand stripping. And I like that two-hand strip because there's always a hand on the line.
You can't slip.
You can't slip. Yeah. You can't miss. And if you're doing this over and over again, and he eats, if you're doing this, and he eats when you're back here, you have to scissor set him and get lucky that you have enough pull there to penetrate the fish. This, you're always ready to pop one hand and drive that hook in. But after I missed that big fish, two-hand stripping, Carlos was like, no more two-hand strips. Mm-hmm. Single-hand strips only. Mm-hmm. And you developed a little bit of a theory about that.
Well, yeah. So, like, in steelheading, there's this debate since the existence of swinging flies for steelhead of... Do you let the fish take it? Do you hit them right away as soon as you feel a bump? Do you have a loop in your line to let them take a little bit more? And I think it's really similar with the two-hand strip versus the single-hand strip, where the single-hand strip is letting the fish take it before you set on it. Because if you come back here and the fish eats, you can scissor set them, but it still gave the fish an opportunity to really take the fly before you actually hit them. Or the fish takes while you're here, and it takes the fly, and then you can come back and then hit them. And I had one fish that took it really well on that versus a two-handed strip where I dropped some fish. Now, to culminate enough data to prove that theory, one or the other with any game species
it's the same as steelhead, where every fish is going to eat the fly in a slightly different way, and there's no guarantees.
No, and I don't, we were like, we would need hundreds of years worth of data neatly compiled to form one or the other, and there are legendary guys out there that maybe do both or are on one side of the fence or the other. Carlos is definitely a guy that believes in both and is trying his best to read the fish and how they're taking.
Well, yeah, that's the other thing. You got to read the mood, because consistently you'll have fish that'll like swat at a fly and they'll come up and they'll pluck it. And it's definitely, it feels like a reactive territorial kind of strike where they're just like, get that out of my face.
Yeah.
And then you have fish that eat the fly.
Yes.
Yeah. They're like, I'm going to kill that thing and it's going in my belly.
Yeah.
And I think if they're doing that, then two-hand strip is the move.
All the way.
Just stay consistent, stay tight. They're going to grab the fly. You're not going to miss the hook set. It's fine. But if they pluck it, giving them a little bit of opportunity to like grab it and turn before instead of being auto tension.
The one that I hit on the rocks, like right before it ate, I like missed a cadence in my strip.
Really?
Yeah.
But they see, like, that's the other part of the theory where it's like, maybe they like the stop and go, and that's what enticed the eat. There's all of that.
The pause in the strip.
Yeah.
Well, and I try to mix it up with the two-hand strip, so you get the rod under your arm.
Right.
And sometimes I'll just hold my right hand, so I'll have the rod under my arm, and I'll hold my right hand here around the line, and then I'll strip through my right hand.
Huh.
And that way, if a fish eats while I'm doing this and I'm at the bottom of this strip, I can pop him with my right hand. I'm always ready for that, but I'm getting the action of a single hand strip.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
And sometimes I'll do like 1-2, 1-1, 1-2-3, 1.
Yeah, like in a skitter pop type.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We do that for bass a ton too.
Oh, yeah.
Especially at night.
But the thing with bass is, no matter where the hook touches,
you're going to get a piece.
You're going to get a piece. You're going to get a chunk of meat in a bass's mouth.
Yeah, exactly.
Those stripers, they got a little bit of bone right on the top, and other than that, you're pretty good. And your hooks are all pointed down.
This is winning the lottery. And I think
these fish, it's just straight bone all around.
It's crazy.
And there's this like gummy layer around their lower lip that is real easy to penetrate and real easy to pull out of.
Well, that day at lunch, we found a skull. Where Carlos found a skull. He was swimming around and found a 10-pound Dorado skull.
Yeah.
And we got a real close look of like, how much of that skull is truly bone and where meat and skin would lie, and there's not a lot of space for it, and if it is there, it's super thin.
Yeah, your best case scenario is right in the corner and go through the gill plate.
Yeah, that maxillary gill plate section is where, that's the sweet spot. That's the softest, strongest tissue to grab a hold of in that fish.
I think the biggest takeaway from it is there's no rules. There's nothing there's nothing that you can do to guarantee that you're going to catch a fish. It's and chaos. You just need to stay consistent, and you need to stay smooth, and you need to stay collected, and eventually the pieces will come together. But if you get in your head, if you get worried about it, if you keep trying new things, if you panic, you're just going to ruin the experience for yourself. You're going to destroy your chances.
You're going to be in a bad way.
You're going to have a bad time.
In a bad way.
But no, it also just makes you want to come back over and over again.
Oh, dude, I feel like this place feels like home.
There's
something so connecting about this river. It's like magnetic.
All the lodges that set fly fishing has for Dorado are insane, and they're just like trying to find these new places, whether they like say Jetu is Action and Alondra and Ibira is Beauty and Itati is Challenge. And it might just be our personalities, but Itati has also been around the longest. So this place, like we started here, you guys immediately felt at home. You were here last year. I felt that sense of homeness here immediately. Just the people are so welcoming and amazing. And then we come back at the end of the trip and you're like hugging Brian and Orlando and all the staff, and like you have this connection to them. And I want nothing more than to like come back next season, because one, maybe the river will accept me. But two, just this place is incredible, and it's really a huge thanks to Set for not only having us down here, but the reason we're down here is not because they want a lodge spotlight video. It's not because they want us to promote their operations. It's because they really care about the fish, and they really want what comes out of all the video that we've been doing and all the interviews is that people will feel like they're educated on the species.
Yeah, wow. We want people in North America to understand what a Dorado is and why these fish are important and why we need to push for science and research and conservation.
Yeah, so thank you to Seth, Gustavo, Andy, all the probably the best guides I've ever fished with.
Incredible guides. Incredible hosts. It's just...
It's going to be hard leaving this place in 30 minutes.
Yeah, they're all just so passionate about this place, down to just the smallest details. And it shows in every interaction you have with everybody here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah, if you want little fish, and a lot of them, if you want big fish, if you want to go to the marsh and experience the most insane wildlife and fish the wetlands for beautiful Dorado, definitely hit up Set. They will create a home for you, and be really careful because you're gonna get addicted.
Yeah. And if you like these like little trip recaps that we do, like we go on a lot of different adventures, please leave a review on Spotify or Apple or any of those places. Let us know in the comments, or shoot us a like message if you want to see more of these. Like, we'd love to do them. We love talking about fish. We might not be like the most insane anglers in the world, but we can tell you about our experiences, and we like doing that privately. So why not share? Why not make you listen to it? So
if you like it, hit us up.
Yeah, thanks guys. We'll see you next time.
Later.